Welcome to the We Collide podcast. We're a growing community of everyday chicks colliding with Jesus in our mess, our pain, our joy, and our stories. We value showing up as we truly are, so that's what you'll find here. Walls and masks being torn down so that we can allow Jesus to meet us where we truly are and hear about other women doing the same. We can't wait to collide with you.
Christian life is not about me being strong and brave and amazing and all of that. It's about me. It's about my weakness being married to Jesus's strength.
Welcome to the We Collide podcast. I'm Willow Weston, the founder and director of Collide, and I am very excited to have a conversation today with Mary DeMuth centering around sexual abuse and how the church and its people can enter into all of this pain. Mary is an author, a speaker, and a podcaster who's passionate about helping people live a restoried life. She herself is a survivor of neglect and sexual abuse and has spent her life healing from trauma. Her story makes others feel less alone in theirs. She is a wife, a mother to three adult children, and a champion of both the church and the movement to support abuse victims. She recently sent me a copy of her book, We Too, which I'm very excited to read, but even more excited right now is to hear from the author herself. So Mary, welcome to the We Collide podcast.
Thanks so much, Willow. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Can you tell us about this passion and how it began rising up in you to support sexual abuse victims?
Well, it's definitely been a part of my life for my whole life. I am a sexual abuse survivor of childhood sexual abuse for about a year of my life. And I've been talking about this issue for a really long time, but it's only been in the past couple of years that people have really been receptive to it. I feel like in so many ways, I was a voice crying out in the wilderness. Not to say I'm like John the Baptist, but I was Mary the Proclaimer. And so it's just been really heartening to see a shift and for people to really begin to start talking about this issue that's been hidden in shame and in secrecy for so long. And I believe that people telling their stories is what sets them free. So it's been really cool to watch.
Speaking of people telling their stories, how long did you keep your story in the quiet, or did you?
I actually am a little bit of a rare bird in the sense that when the sexual abuse was happening when I was 5 years old, I was being molested by neighborhood teenage boys, and they would take me away from my babysitter's house. And the babysitter, I think, well, of course, she knew exactly what was going on, but she just didn't want to be bothered. So after a while, probably 7 months or so, I just knew that I was going to die if they continued to do what they were doing. They started inviting other people. And so I actually told her when I was five. I told her what was going on, and she said, "I will tell your mom." And I thought, okay, well, I'm set free. I don't have to worry about this anymore. But the next day, those boys knocked on the babysitter's door again, and she made me go out and be with them again. And so at that point, I believe that she told me the truth, that she told my mom and my mom didn't care. And so I decided the only way to save myself was to sleep. And so I would get home from half day kindergarten. I would eat my sandwich. I would run into her bedroom and I would pull the covers over my head. And then I would just pretend to sleep for hours. And that actually did save me for a period of time. And then thankfully we moved away from that locale at the end of my school year and I was set free from that. But I kept that story quiet. To answer your question, I kept it quiet for another 10 years because I believed it didn't matter. And finally, when I, after I had met Christ, I finally got up the bravery to kind of talk about it publicly with, you know, a family member. And it was hard because I was not believed and I had to retell the story excruciatingly so many times to convince the person that it was true. And so that's why I understand the dynamics of why people don't share, because they might even have tried to share and it didn't matter.
For those people listening who haven't experienced sexual abuse, and I know the people listening who have are right there with you, but for those who haven't, what is that like to feel like you're not being believed in your story?
Well, it's a form of secondary violation. And I've talked to enough survivors today to know that it's actually a very real thing. And you know, have gone through so much trauma and then suddenly they're not believed, and to have to retell it and retry to convince people is just agonizing, because already they're a trauma survivor and they're, you know, dealing with flashbacks and things like that. So I always tell people, err on the side of belief. Most people do not make a false outcry. And so just err on the side of listening, crying, and believing.
How, when you were ready to share publicly and come out with your story, what was your experience with the church? How did they meet you in your pain when you came out with it?
I actually had a really positive experience. So I met Christ when I was 15 through the ministry of Young Life in the Seattle area. And I think I was just so broken. I immediately started talking to my Young Life leaders about what I had gone through. And then by the time I got to college is when I began to tell that story. And thankfully, I was in a good church community of people who believed that Jesus would heal me. And so the church's initial response to me was very sweet-tempered and awesome and kind-hearted. And they would listen to me, they would cry with me, and they would pray with me. And that was really the foundation of a lot of the healing that I experienced. Now, I understand that that's not always the case for people. I have counseled many who went to the church believing that that would be a safe place and instead were maligned or questioned or pushed away or told to be silent. And so I understand that there's a couple different sides of this nuanced story.
I was just going to ask you, how do you see the church getting it wrong?
There's a couple different areas. And so as I'm talking about this issue, I have to delineate between two things. One is just the average person in the church who's been sexually abused. That's one issue of how the church deals with them. The other issue is separate, and that's what happens if within the structure of the church, someone in that structure has abused. And that's a whole different thing. But I do think that the church can do better by sharing stories from the front. These are actually biblical stories. There's biblical narratives of rape throughout the Bible, and we just don't talk about them. But I would really love to see people sharing their stories so that people like me in the pews wouldn't feel like I'm a freak and I'm the only one with a story, even though I know all the statistics that I'm not. By the sheer fact that it's never talked about, I feel like something's wrong with me. So having that told, and then in terms of when it happens within a church structure, I believe that transparency and authenticity and brokenness are probably the better way to deal with it. In other words, we messed up. This happened on our watch. We are so sad. We're contacting the authorities. We're contacting the media. We're going to be authentic and open about it and just move forward from there instead of trying to cover it up and pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You write in your book, you have seven crucial misunderstandings that you found when people in churches face, and you talk about churches becoming safe havens. Tell us about that misunderstanding that you mentioned, misunderstanding what the church is.
Yeah. So I think we forget that the church is not, at least how I've been studying it over the years and the ecclesiology of it all, it's not a corporate structure. It's not CEO led, even though we do have a lot of those structures in our churches today, especially in North America. But the church is actually a body of called out people who are just hoping to bear light in a dark world. And so when we understand that, we begin to see too that those who are the weakest in the church structure, if we read through Corinthians about the body, those are actually the most dignified parts. Those are the folks that we deem with more esteem, because I believe that sexual abuse victims are part of our tutors to lead us closer to Christ, because they have understood what it's like to have lack. And the Christian life is not about me being strong and brave and amazing and all of that. It's about me. It's about my weakness being married to Jesus's strength. So who better to teach us about the strength of Jesus than those who have been weakened by things that have happened to them?
It's so interesting. So much of our work around here at Collide is really inviting people in their brokenness and their pain to run into Jesus and really being a loud voice that says he can handle all of your pain. And I continue to be amazed at the stories of women. I just spoke at a retreat this last weekend, and there was like woman after woman. There was a woman who just left an abusive marriage and moved back into her parents' home, and her father molested her as a child, and now she's back sleeping on his couch. And just this idea that I just have to kind of act like this didn't happen because no one in my family can handle this. My church can't handle this. You know, talk to another woman who broke up with a boyfriend years ago, 11 years ago, because he wasn't a Christian and she didn't feel called to marry him as she became a new believer. And 5 months later, he committed suicide on her birthday. And she was crying at this retreat because she was so upset because she was confused. She believed that if she was good with God, she should no longer be sad and cry over the loss of someone who ended their life. So I feel like I spend time with all these women who've been made to almost believe, almost like we've taught a God who, about a God who can't handle pain. And I love the work that you're doing where you're kind of dismantling that around sexual abuse and saying, tell your story, come out with your story. God can handle your pain. How are you seeing traction with that as you continue to invite women to tell?
Well, I'm seeing a lot of freedom, thankfully, and I would, as what you said, really resonated with me because I think, of course, the Lord can handle our pain because He took on the sins of humanity on His shoulders. So, He already knows. I think that's one of the things that we forget when we are talking about our stories. It's like, well, I don't want to bother God with that story. Well, guess what? He already knows. He already knows we're struggling with it. So, it's actually a gift to give our Lord as a, you know, as our offering is to give Him our story and to say, help me with this. And to answer the other part of your question is I've been watching and seeing people be set free for the very first time. I've met with women who are in their 70s who have never let their story out and finally let it out into the free air. And the immediate burden is dropped in that moment in the light of truth. I believe the enemy of our souls would rather us keep things quiet because in that quiet, the enemy's voice gets really loud and really repetitive. And so he knows that if we let out our story, someone else will say, I understand what that's like. It's, you're not alone. This is hard. Yes, I weep with you. And then all of that angst is going to go away. So the enemy is going to prevent us from telling our stories. And so therefore, it's an audacious act of faith to actually let them out into the air with safe people. And I would caution that you don't want to just willy-nilly share your story with a random person. You want to be able to vet that person and they should be a safe person.
So you held your story in, you said, I think you said for 10 years. What happens to women who are kind of haunted by this sexual abuse and they're alone in their story? What are the symptoms that sort of come out sideways because they have to keep quiet in that?
I have developed a checklist and I have a thing on we2.org/21days where I give all the, for 21 days, I send emails about all the best practices I've learned in healing from sexual abuse. One of those days is the sexual abuse impact quiz. It's free. And there are so many ways that we have been affected. And basically, if you want to find those, you can go to any sort of lists of trauma. So if you go on the internet and say, PTSD effects, you'll find all those things. But we're seeing like, especially with children who have gone through it, all sorts of ways that we've been affected physically, emotionally, mentally, a lot of autoimmune diseases, a lot of weight problems, a lot of anxiety and depression, suicidal ideation, physical problems that cannot be explained. All of these trace back to that kind of trauma in the past.
Do you have a definition for sexual abuse? I mean, I'm just listening to you talk and I'm thinking about those of us listening who maybe are kind of justifying some things that happened to us. I'm being very honest right now. I'm even thinking in my own life, things that I've never really talked about or shared. Do you have some sort of definition? Cause I think sometimes we think, oh, that wasn't rape. That was just weird. Or like, what is the definition of how does one know was one to find. This wasn't normal. This was actually inappropriate.
One way that will really help is if you are a mom and you place your child in that situation and you think about if it happened to them and you know it's wrong and you would have beat that person up, then you know that what you experienced was abuse. I think one of the problems that we have is we hear a lot of trauma stories and we think, oh, well, that's not like what I had. I didn't have full penetration of my, you know, the sexual assault. But in Dan Allender's book, The Wounded Heart, he talks about the fact that in healing from sexual assault, it is the same length of healing and depth of healing, whether you had a creepy uncle put his hand on your leg and leer at you versus someone, you know, attacking you on the street and raping you. And so sexual abuse is an overpowering of the will. It's taking your agency away from you. It's an abuse of power. And, you know, it could even be surrogate spouse abuse, which is when a parent pretends that you're their spouse, even though there's no sex involved. They treat you as if you're their confidant, like a spouse would be. There's a lot of different layers to sexual assault and sexual abuse. But I think one of the easiest ways to do it is to place someone you love in that situation and then evaluate your feelings about if they had been harmed that same way, how would you feel about it? Because when we're in our heads, we have a hard time tethering that out. And we always compare ourselves to some worse assault and think, well, it doesn't matter because that one's worse. Well, guess what? It does matter because it has affected you. And it is important to shed light on that and get some help and therapy and healing along the way.
That's really good. That's really good. So statistics. I came across a CNN article last week, just randomly, knowing I was going to interview you, but I wasn't looking up statistics. This was an article that they just put out, and it says 1 in 16 U.S. women, their first experience with sexual intercourse is rape.
Yeah.
That stopped me in my tracks. I literally printed it out, and it's sitting on my desk. That should bother us.
It should horrify us. And I wish that it would. That's my story. That was my first sexual experience. So many women have that story that the very first time was that. I was just finishing up Rachel Den Hollander's book, What is a Girl Worth? And, you know, she was the first to report Dr. Larry Nassar for abusing her. And that was her first experience, was on the table in a doctor's office where she should have been safe, and her mom was in the room. And it's just, it's horrifying to think about that. Of course, we're warped in the way we view sex. Of course, it affects us. And, you know, for me, I'll just be honest and say it was difficult for me being married. I'm still married, 29 years now, but that was hard. Understanding sex as beautiful is excruciating for me. It's not an easy thing. That's not where my mind goes. And so my husband and I have had to work through a lot of that and trying to recapture what had been stolen from me.
How do you think we as the church and we as God's people can create these safe spaces and relationships where women could share their story and come out and receive support and healing?
Well, having those stories from the front is so important so that we don't feel alone anymore. Having systems in place is really helpful. On we2.org/pastors, you don't have to be a pastor to go there. I have a free download of, I think it's like 30 pages of resources, and you can curate those resources to the ones that fit your church. But a lot of churches, I think, especially pastors, get freaked out by sexual abuse, and they just realize if they open up the can of worms, the worms will be out, and they don't know what to do. But a pastor isn't called to be everything to everybody, but they are called to be a shepherd. And so what that would look like is if someone made an outcry to the pastor and said, I've been abused and I'm trying to work through this, the pastor could say, I am so sorry. They can weep alongside, they can pray, and then they can say, this is not in my wheelhouse, but here is a list of resources resources that this church has personally vetted. We have this counseling center we recommend. Here's some ways to apply for scholarships to be able to go to that kind of counseling. We have some Stevens ministers here, people who will walk alongside some mentorship programs. We also have some sexual abuse recovery, or this church down the road does. And having these kinds of resources is really what's necessary. And it doesn't mean that that pastor has to be the person to fix the problem, so to speak.
Right, right. Well, totally. I mean, we started doing conferences at Collide, and the more that we grew and the more that we invited people to share their stories, these kinds of things came out. And when you have hundreds of people starting to share the real stuff and they need help beyond what you can give them, that's what actually started our counseling program, where we help even pay for people to get counseling who need it. It's just so important that the church begins to fiercely decide that we're not going to just ignore this. We're going to talk about it. We're going to invite those stories. And then we're going to fiercely walk alongside women to get them the help that they need. It's so, so important. I love that you're calling pastors to that. What about us as women? How do we become safe spaces for other women in friendship where they can begin to process some of the stuff that they've gone through?
I think having a really robust overview of the book of Job is really helpful. And the nutshell of that is that when Job lost everything, his friends in that first moment were amazing. They got in the pit with him, the dust. They simply wept and they said nothing. And then for the rest of Job, they decided that they actually need to say a bunch of things. And they had lots of cliched statements and blame and victim blaming and all of that kind of stuff. And at the end of the book of Job, God rebukes those friends because they were not good friends. And so I think we can take that to heart, that it's not, I think a lot of us fear, we're like, well, I don't know what to say. Actually, there's probably nothing to say. You just, Romans 12:15, you weep with someone who weeps. You tell them you're so sorry. You pray for them. You listen. And that's really all that's necessary to be empathetic and caring. And if you feel out of your league, and if you feel like your friend is going to you for everything and they want you to be their counselor, then that's when you find some other resources for them, but you still stick with them and you love them and pray for them.
Mm. Do you, when you look back to sharing your story, do you have a moment like that that you remember that was like a turning point for you where someone showed you that kind of compassion?
Yes. I remember being on a mountaintop in, outside of Malibu, a Young Life camp in Canada. And I was sharing with a group of people. I was on this backpacking trip, and I shared my story. And one of the guys on the crew that was with me, he just was very sweet and empathetic and was just broken by the story. And he just wept alongside me. And I think there's just something really powerful about that, of someone who's like, I don't know what to say, but this is terrible. And I'm going to cry with you. And it was just really powerful for me.
Yeah. When you see Jesus, we call it collide. When you see Jesus collide or run into someone who was exploited or victimized or shamed, how do you see him respond? And how is that fueling how you're teaching others to respond?
Well, that's kind of the simple way. When I'm talking to churches, I just ask them that question. I just say, hey, if Jesus were standing here right now and a sexual abuse victim came up to him and told him their story, how would he respond? And then I say, go and do the same. And we can simply look at the narrative of the Good Samaritan, where the one who fell among the thieves was actually Jewish, and his compatriots walked on by. And not only compatriots, not only fellow Jews, but priests and a Levite, they walked by, the clergy walked by. And yet it was a hated Samaritan, someone on the outside who did the right thing. And we're seeing that a lot in the church right now, sadly. It's the press, and it is the law, the system of law that we have. Those are the entities that are helping victims right now and survivors. And the church is walking alongside on the other side. So my encouragement is, we need to just be more like Jesus, and we need to be more like the Good Samaritan. I also find it fascinating that the Pharisees compared Jesus to a Samaritan. So I find it kind of interesting. He's like, yeah, well, maybe we should be like that, when he told that story.
You write, this is our We Too movement, to purposely suffer alongside the sexually broken. What are some practical ways our listeners can suffer alongside abuse survivors today? I mean, you've talked about some of them, but that suffering idea is even different than listening and weeping with someone. And then when you talk about the press and you talk about, you know, people in law, and they're actually the ones that are standing up for sexual abuse victims, and the church is not known for that. How do we begin to co-suffer as a church and as a God's people along with these people who have suffered so much?
Individually, it's similar to what I've said, to say, I believe you, and I'm so sorry, and I wish it didn't happen to you. And maybe even ask the question, how can I be of help? Because maybe you don't know, and maybe they haven't even been asked that before. They've just received help without someone asking them what they actually needed. And then corporately, I think it's got to come from the leadership of our churches, where, like, one of the things that's really heartening to me is I go to a large Southern Baptist mega church in Texas, and the elders of our church are reading this book and they're discussing it. And that's where the change is going to happen. Of course, it will change from the grassroots. It will change from us, you know, talking about this issue, but it also changes from the top down, where the leadership understands finally in a pastoral way what their people are walking through, and then creating systems and ways of helping people that are life-giving and full of light.
Right, because if leaders can shape culture and recognize that in their pews every single weekend, even the statistic of 1 in 16 of the women in their pews had their first sexual experience being rape, that should be a consideration on how am I meeting and engaging these women on a weekly basis.
And sadly, a lot of them just haven't been engaged. It's just like we've ignored the issue and pretended it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. So true. You use the phrase restoried a lot. How can we become restoried?
For me, it works with the metaphor of what you guys are talking about and colliding with Jesus and connecting with him. I wouldn't be standing here giving a podcast interview about grace and redemption and hope and light if it weren't for Jesus. And he utterly and completely rescued me. And to me, that looks like bending the knee and surrendering afresh and worshiping him and asking the hard questions. It's okay to ask, where were you when this happened? That's a normal question. It's not going to hurt his feelings if we ask that question. It's just going to actually deepen our relationship and help us to wrestle it through with him.
Mm. What's a story that you've experienced recently that just continues to remind you of the beautiful healing of Jesus and how he's met a woman in her sexual abuse story and brought about healing and transformation?
Well, it's kind of a cautionary tale, actually. I was speaking to an audience, and this woman came up to me. She's probably in her 50s, and she told me about her mom, and she said, my mom was sexually abused. I didn't know until last year. And she was crying, and she said, it just makes so much sense now because of how she treated us and how she was. And so I asked her, would it have been a gift for you if she had pursued healing earlier? And she broke down into tears. And what I gathered from that, or the lesson that I learned from that, is that I think a lot of women, we're busy, we're tired, we're just trying to make our life work. And we just want to shove down all the uncomfortable things because we don't want to deal with them. Or we might think, oh, it's super selfish and narcissistic to think about my issues. I'm just going to keep going and helping all the other people in my life. But actually, the greatest gift that you can give to your children, to your husband, to your friends, to your family members and extended family, and to your work, is a healed heart. And so there is something really beautiful about this pursuit of healing with Jesus. And it's not selfish to do that. When Jesus heals your heart, it makes you a better mom. It makes you a better wife. It makes you a better follower of him. It makes you a better friend. And so my encouragement to everyone is to heed that and not to be like the 70-year-old woman who was mean to her family for a really long time because she couldn't spill the story, but spill it, get it out, tell it to someone safe, and start believing that there's going to be some healing there. And the ripple effect will not only affect your kids, but generations to come. You are putting a holy stake in the ground and you're saying, no longer on my watch am I going to live in secrecy.
That's so good. For those who are listening to this and they've been living in pain and secrets and it still hurts like crazy, what's your best advice for them?
Best advice is to find a friend who loves well, who is safe, who will listen and let it out. And then you can begin to study. There's a lot of books out there on trauma and all those resources are at we2.org. So if they go to we2.org, there's a resource tab and they can find all of the recommended books and just begin to become a student of healing and be bold and ask for prayer. That has really been the backbone of my healing. I have, of course, been to therapy. I have done EMDR and some of those other trauma type therapies, of course. But honestly, what's healed me most is people listening to my story and praying for me.
So good. I think about you and how brave you were to come out with your story in a book. And for so many reasons, I resonate with you. I'm sitting on a book right now and I'm afraid to come out with my story in a way because my story was not always welcomed in its to be told, right? And I think, you know, you mentioned something earlier, you talked about secondary violation, that if you tell your story and people don't believe you or they question it or you'll feel that pain all over again. I can't imagine the fear maybe that you had to push through to come out with a story so publicly in a book. Tell us about the kind of bravery this required for you to help other people.
Well, it goes back several years. So the first time I wrote that story was in a chapter of my second book, and I've written 39 now or 42 books. So this was my second book. Yeah. I've been writing for a while, but in my second book, it was called Building the Christian Family You Never Had. It's a Waterbrook Multnomah book. And I knew that in order to encourage parents who were pioneer parents and doing what they didn't want to see, you know, from their past, that I had to tell my story. And I was absolutely terrified. It was going to be the first time in print I had ever done it. And I couldn't. And I was about ready to hand back the book advance. I was petrified. And during that time, God saw fit to reunite me with one of my stepfathers who had become a Christian in the meantime. And so here was this man who was the only one of my family who understood my Christianity and also remembered my story. And so that gave me the bravery to be able to do it. But I did have a couple fears. So I wrote it, and then as it was about ready to be published, the editor said, you need to send it to your family members because of legal reasons. So I sent it. My husband and I and our kids were living in France. We were church planters at the time. I was terrified, and I was worried that the first thing that I was worried about was the person that I disclosed it to would say, it never happened, you're a liar, and second, that they would withdraw their love from me. And so I sent it via email over the Atlantic Ocean, and I waited and waited and waited. And I got the email back. And honestly, my fears were absolutely realized. I was questioned. It didn't happen. And the person's love was truly and deeply taken away from me. And in that moment, I felt like I was I was watching The Wizard of Oz when Toto pulled back the curtain, and you see the wizard is just this short man standing on a box pulling levers. And up until that moment, I had had so much fear about this particular family member that they seemed like they were 14 feet tall. But I realized I could have the worst thing happen to me. Someone could question me and say it didn't happen and then withdraw their love from me and harm me that way. And I was still standing. And that gave me the bravery to finish that book. And it also gave me the bravery to write my memoir the next, you know, couple of years from then, called Thin Places, which is really my story in memoir form. And from that time on, I no longer was afraid of telling my story. So that's kind of a long answer, but that's kind of how I worked through it.
But I love that you're living your own message. You call us to suffer with sexual abuse victims. And in a way, you are doing that now by writing this book, by doing this work, by coming out with your story, telling it over and over again, risking ruining relationship with people who doubt you because you know it's true and you know that Jesus can powerfully use it. You're just an inspiration, Mary.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. How can people get your book, We Too, and any other book? And how can people connect with you?
Yeah. So the book is wherever books are sold. Obviously, Amazon, any Christian bookstore. It's a Harvest House title. And they can find out more information at wetoo.org or find me at marydemuth.com. And again, if there's someone out there listening who wants some help and just begin their healing journey, they can go to wetoo.org/21days. And if they want all those resources in one handy place, they can go to wetoo.org/pastors.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing your heart with us today, Mary.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And for those of you listening, please do go grab Mary's book and check her out and seek out resources. If you need additional help in getting the help that you need, please email us at info@weakallied.net and we will walk alongside you and help you get whatever help you need. And we will catch you next week. Keep colliding.
Thanks for tuning in. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram @we.collide, on Facebook as @WeCollideWomen, and you can also visit our website at wecollide.net to find our blog, resources, event information, and more. One last thing. If you enjoyed this episode, would you take a few seconds and leave us a review? It seems like such a small act, but reviews help us to keep producing this content and help other women find it too. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode and letting us walk with you as you seek and collide with Jesus.